the best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is predicting an above-average Atlantic hurricane season. We'll speak with the president of Vassar College about how President Trump's executive orders are affecting smaller private colleges. And how well can you spell? I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is predicting an above-average Atlantic hurricane season. The season that began June 1st runs through the end of November. Dr. Kristen Corbacero, a professor at the Department of Atmospheric and Environmental Science at the University at Albany, agrees that early signs point to an active 2025 hurricane season. I spoke with her to learn more about what factors are considered when predicting the next several months.
For this upcoming hurricane season in the Atlantic, NOAA's predicting an above-average season, maybe not as active as what they were predicting last year because the waters are slightly cooler this year. We're in a neutral El Nino state, so that doesn't favor or inhibit storms. But given we're in a warming climate, going above the long-term average is always a smart bet if they're forecasting for the season.
Now, does this follow recent trends as well, having an above average ocean temperature and air temperature for the year?
It does. So the waters aren't quite as warm as they were last season when we were going into last season when they were predicting a hyperactive season, but they are warmer than the long-term sort of average over the last 20 or 30 years. And since the fuel for hurricanes is warm ocean waters, it makes sense to predict an above average season.
Now, how are these predictions actually made? Besides temperature, what actually goes into the formula that leads to the prediction?
Right. So there's a lot of different things that go into it. One of them is the ocean state, and not just the ocean state in the Atlantic, but also in the Pacific Ocean. So the El Nino Southern Oscillation that we hear about from time to time does play a role in governing how many hurricanes happen around the globe. And in the Atlantic, we don't want a lot of storms, but for more hurricanes, it generally is in a La Nina state, which is colder in the Pacific. But this year, there isn't really warm or cold water there. So it goes to the ocean. It also depends on sort of long-term trends of whether the ocean is warmer or cooler in the Atlantic. Also, how many thunderstorms we expect to come off of Africa, these thunderstorm complexes that then turn into storms. So there seems to maybe be hints that there's going to be more of those this year. So there's a number of different atmospheric and oceanic things that go into predicting how many storms will form.
Now, I do want to back up just a little bit to talk about the El Nino and the La Nina. And every few years you hear about it on the news. And I remember I was a kid in the 90s and that was a big topic of conversation and people made jokes. Oh, blame El Nino, you know, kind of that kind of a thing. But what is El Nino actually, and how does it have such an impact on something like the hurricane season?
Right. So El Nino specifically refers to warming or cooling waters happening off the coast of South America, that usually there's an ocean current that goes from east to west off the coast of South America that keeps that water cool. That's the normal state. But when that water warms, that's called El Nino. It usually happens around December. That's why it's called El Nino, as the Christ child. So there is a history to the name. If there's colder water there throughout the year, that's the La Nina state. And if it's warmer water, that's the El Nino state. But it also affects what happens in the Western Pacific. And it's a sort of a global phenomenon. There's the atmosphere responds to all that warmer, colder water. And so if the water is colder during the summer months, that leads to what we refer to as less vertical wind shear. So vertical wind shear is how the winds change with height. And that's if we have a lot of wind shear, that's not good for hurricanes. And so if we have colder waters off the coast of South America, that generally leads to more hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean. But this year, the waters are neither warm nor cold. So it's neither good or bad in terms of that particular factor.
But because, now going back to how we started this conversation, because things are trending warmer, even with a neutral El Nino state, we're still predicting an active hurricane season.
Right, because over the Atlantic Ocean itself, the waters are generally warmer than the long-term, say, 20 or 30-year average.
Now, last year, especially in the southeastern United States, there were some very destructive hurricanes, ones that lingered for a long time, that traveled up mm-hmm. through into Appalachia, which is rather unusual, I guess, for somebody who's been paying attention to this for the last few decades. But because of the predictions that NOAA has come up with for the Atlantic hurricane season this year, can we expect similar, longer, lingering storms that we've seen in 2024?
Right. So landfall, whether the storms are going to make landfall, is a little bit harder to predict on a longer time scale. The sort of track of storms more responds to weather patterns that are happening on a weekly or biweekly basis. And really, it only takes, whether there's an active hurricane season or not active, it really only takes one storm to cause devastation, right? So that's one factor. Another factor is there's been studies that have shown recently that in a warming climate, that the wind patterns that steer hurricanes are weakening because all weather comes down to temperature sort of gradients, how strong temperatures change with latitude. And if you have a warming climate everywhere, the winds are weaker. And so storms are slowing down. And this has been known for some research that's been around for at least 5 years now and has been linked to things like Helene, which just sort of parked itself over Appalachia. There was also a number of storms that slowed down that brought devastating rainfalls to the Houston area. So we know storms are moving slower. The slower they move, the more chance they park over an area and bring really the devastating rainfall. That is really the number one destructive factor once storms move on land.
So it almost seems like because of wind, and the wind has the power to snuff out a hurricane almost. Can I think of it that way?
Yeah. So in terms of wind shear, how the winds change with height, that can snuff out a hurricane even when it's over the waters. But if we are moving, if there's less wind, storms might slow down and just stay in one area.
Now, I wanted to ask about, there's a lot of cuts in government right now, and organizations like NOAA are affected. Is the ability to predict storms impacted in any way?
I think it's going to be a really interesting season to see. That we're very fortunate that the National Hurricane Center, which is part of NOAA and the National Weather Service, is nearly fully staffed. So in terms of the people, the hurricane specialists that are on duty doing the forecasting, they have a nearly fully staffed office. But a number of weather services offices along the Gulf Coast are not fully staffed. That the Houston office specifically made a lot of headlines recently for not having a fully staffed office because of people who retired and sort of took the retirement packages that were offered. The Weather Service has offered people can now move, that they had, they opened it up so people from other offices could move into offices that were deemed sort of really low staffing. But I think it is a concern that those Weather Service offices take over when a hurricane comes on landfall. Predicting that heavy rainfall we talked about really falls to the Weather Service offices. So that, I think, is a concern. The we use a lot of models, weather models, to forecast hurricanes. The configuration of the model every year is set pretty early. So that's probably, set for this year. But thinking about future improvements of our models, that might be in jeopardy because of low staffing. So I think it is a concern going into this season. We also know that there'll probably be fewer hurricane flights by our NOAA partners that fly into hurricanes and gather data. There'll likely be fewer of those this year. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. But I think everyone is concerned about some of the factors you mentioned.
So now, just to go back to the hurricanes and the upcoming season, does it entertain you in a way to keep track of things and see how they match up with the predictions? What will you be looking for as the year goes on?
Yeah, a lot of my work focuses on hurricane structure and how that leads to intensity change. And so the flights that I mentioned into hurricanes really form a basis of a lot of work that I do. And so that's what I look at. I think that always sort of seeing if the predictions match up and then why if they didn't. It's always a question that happens during the season. You know, last year we had a storm early and then a big lull and then a lot of activity at the end of the season. So that was a really interesting factor. You know, it's always interesting to see how the season plays out and what storms form, where they track, what kind of the atmosphere is always doing interesting things and changing. So tracking those things in real time is a big part of what I do during the summer. Whether it's an active season or an interactive, it only takes really one storm to cause devastation. So people staying aware of forecasts, even up in Albany, we know that storms or the remnants can make it up here. So it's always good to be aware.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Kristen Corbacero is a professor at the Department of Atmospheric and Environmental Science at the University at Albany. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. President Trump has repeatedly targeted colleges and universities with threats to remove their federal funding or even their ability to enroll certain students unless they follow his initiatives. The Republican has especially singled out Harvard University with billions of funding cuts. He has also threatened to remove Harvard's tax-exempt status and its ability to enroll international students. A federal judge has blocked the foreign student ban as a lawsuit proceeds. But smaller colleges like Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, are grappling with how to respond to the president's executive orders and whether to take them seriously. WAMC's Jesse King spoke with Vassar College president Elizabeth Bradley.
It's a little bit of a roller coaster. I like roller coasters, but that doesn't mean it's all easy. There are moments that I think one is really fearful that what we have held dear is on the chopping block, like the NIH funding. NIH funding is absolutely fundamental to academics. That's how many, many academics in many scientific fields get their funding to be able to do incredibly important research that actually helps the world, not just the country or their families, particularly in my field, public health. So to see that, the cuts in that, and to see the threats that, oh, you know, you're not going to be able to publish in certain journals if you are NIH funded, that cuts right to the core. And that's the really downside of the roller coaster where you think, what is going to happen? How are we going to come back from this? But then when you convene with peers and the faculty and things change in Washington, you know, we come out the other side and realize, oh, actually, that didn't take away our NIH funding, at least for now. So I would say it's a roller coaster, but on balance, it's important not to overreact. And it's important to think about, is there anything from this we can learn and improve ourselves? And then last, have confidence that we're going to get through.
I know that the administration has also targeted colleges for their diversity, equity, inclusion programs, not just colleges, but, you know, programs across the country. Is the school revisiting its programs in any way or pulling back any of its efforts?
One of the most important things to understand about the executive order to ask higher education to stop doing DEI programs is the order says you cannot do these DEI programs if they discriminate based on race, color, or national origin. So we do not discriminate based on race, color, or national origin. And so we felt as if, okay, I understand. You're telling us don't discriminate, and we don't. So for us, it felt as if we could continue doing what we do. I will say also, that Vassar has invested for 7 or 8 years now in a concept called engaged pluralism, which means keeping all voices at the table and talking across difference, engaging it, not segregating people, not segmenting people, not assimilating people, but rather hold your differences and continue to talk. And that engaged pluralism initiative, I think, is alive and well and really helping us through this time.
There's a lot going on with Harvard right now. The president has tried to ban their ability to even enroll international students. If there were to be such a ban for international students at Vassar, like how much do international students play a role in the enrollment here at this college?
International students are fundamental to our mission. They bring so much, just enormous talent, diversity, and learnings. And I think having international students in the classroom makes the classroom just much more robust. Think about political science, and you're studying the Constitution. Well, the Constitution in China looks different from the Constitution in Ghana, which looks different from the Constitution in Sweden, and we'll have all those students in the classroom and can kind of relate to what are states' rights, what are individual rights. It just makes the conversation so much more robust. So we absolutely treasure our international students and our international faculty. So many faculty here have international backgrounds. And at this point, you know, none of them have been, it hasn't changed anything on campus, but we are fearful of that. About 10% of our students are international. I don't really know the percentage of faculty, but we really hope we can continue as we have.
And I know that the Department of Homeland Security says that it will move to revoke Chinese student visas. Does Vassar enroll a large number of students from China?
We have a chunk of students from China. I'd say maybe 25 in a class. So maybe we have 2,600 students and maybe 100. That's about the numbers that are from China. And we have heard this threat, but again, the roller coaster metaphor, you know, sometimes we've heard in the past there are these threats, you're not sure how they're going to be implemented, and then when the courts get involved, actually there's a pullback from it, and it doesn't happen exactly the way. So we are trying to facilitate. We've been in touch with our Chinese students and our Chinese faculty to say, we support you, we want to help you. We'll do everything we can legally to support these students so they can get their education here.
I mean, we're about a year off now from when there were a lot of pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses across the country. That has also been a reasoning for why the Trump administration is targeting some colleges is for their response to that. What has Vassar learned from its own protests on campus?
We have had protests. They've been peaceful protests. And I think what we've learned is how important it is to really have good relationships on campus before there are protests. One, and two, that you have really good policy frameworks around protests so everybody understands the bounds of protests. We have very strong understanding, I think, at all levels of the institution. You cannot, you know, incite violence, you cannot undertake discriminatory harassment, and you cannot disrupt the educational function so that someone else can't hear a speaker or can't see a speaker. Given that, we've had protests all around that, and people are quite clever in the way they protest. They might stand up and turn their backs, or they might come at graduation and hand me a note at graduation that says something that they believe in. These are all peaceful ways to express, and I think we should all be thanking them for being able to express themselves peacefully, and also thanking the many, many administrators and faculty and students themselves that contain protests from becoming dangerous. And I've been so impressed that our students have been able to do this on this campus.
Looking at next year, how does enrollment look for the class of 2029?
I think we're already there. It looks great. I was so happy that even though there's so much in the news about higher education and fears about higher education, we look like we have a full class and are ready to go. Can't wait.
What would you like to see colleges do during this time?
I do think it's very important for all of us to do some self-reflection. We have the summer. It's the time to, as administrators, but also faculty, really think, what is the message from the public and how are we aligning with what the public needs? I mean, after all, higher education is a public good and we should be figuring out what it is America wants from its higher education field and trying our best to deliver that. So that self-reflection feels very, very important. I think also it's a time to collaborate with each other to talk about what are the best practices, what have you been able to do that actually allows the classrooms to be open and have all kinds of voices talking, how do you keep the peace on campus, how do you figure out how to finance higher education in a way that we can keep keeping our doors open for all levels of income. And I think trading, you know, understanding best practices, it's an important time for us to study the industry. And I guess the last thing is, I think it's an important time to reinvest in who we are. So we come back in the fall and say, okay, there's some things we need to change. And by the way, there are a lot of things we do right, and we're going to keep doing that.
When you say self-reflection, are there specific things that Vassar College is mulling right now?
Our self-reflection that we've always done, we have a very strong governance structure. It's like a 50-page document that's our constitution. And each summer we go through that and say, do we have all the policies we need? Are they clear, et cetera, et cetera? So that we will do again. In terms of specific things, we respond often to things that have happened where we've thought it hasn't been as clear exactly. So last year we reiterated our poster policy, what you can post on campus, what you can't post on campus, things like that. And I think those are the, and then we'll also respond to what executive orders come to say, okay, how do our policies look relative to this new executive order? So we'll do some of that.
Vassar College President Elizabeth Bradley speaking with WAMC's Jesse King. By way of disclosure, Vassar College is home to WAMC's Hudson Valley News Bureau. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The Scripps National Spelling Bee celebrated its 100th birthday in May. The 2025 Spelling Bee was won by Faison Zaki, a 13-year-old from Texas. The event brings together super spellers from across the country, including our next guest. Krisha Agrawal is a fifth-grade student at the Woodland Hill Montessori School in East Greenbush, New York. She traveled to Washington, D.C. for the four-round competition, and WAMC's Samantha Simmons spoke with her ahead of the contest.
It's been my dream since I was like 4 years old to go to the National Spelling Bee. And I've always had a passion for spelling. I've always like asked my teachers to be on the highest list or ask my mom to quiz me on words from the dictionary. I've always loved it.
Besides spelling, what other hobbies do you have? What do you do in your free time?
I'm a brown belt in Taekwondo. I played the violin for like 4 or 5 years. I like to sing and dance. I like to play tennis.
And did your qualification for the National Spelling Bee come as a surprise? I know you had to move through different rounds of different local and regional spelling bees, but when you finally, you know, got that acceptance to the Scripps, what was that like and were you surprised?
I was surprised. I didn't imagine that I would get to go to the Nationals. I mean, I was, like, flabbergasted. I was like, wow. And it was hard to, I mean, it was a lot of rounds. It was, like, 4 spelling bees, I think. It took a while. I was really surprised. It was, like, so what had happened was I had gone to my school one, and then I had gone into an online spelling bee, and then I went to one on a Zoom meeting, and I didn't make it. But 2 days before the regional one, I found out I was in it. So I basically got like a second chance. And I found out like 2 days before that spelling bee. So I started practicing. And obviously, since I only had 2 days to practice for that, I was like, okay, obviously I can't make this. But then I won it.
Are there ever any words that you feel stumped by, but then they just come to you?
So like hard words?
Yeah.
There are a few. So there's one called trompe-l'oeil, and it's spelled TROMPELOEIL. There's pneumonal ultramicroscopic silicovolcanoconiosis.
And that's one? It's,
yeah. And it's spelled PNEUMONOULTRAMICROSILOVOLCANOCIS.
What do your classmates and friends say about your, I mean, I'm sure your vocabulary is a bit more expanded than a lot of theirs, and just the conversations you have with them, what are they saying?
I mean, half of the words I say, they're like,
What are your favorite words or kind of words to spell?
Ooh, I like makadikadipans. It's spelled MAKGADIK. GADI space PANS. Makadikadipans.
And what does that mean?
It's a type of saltwater pan that's used in Africa. yeah, it's, I don't know, ever since I found it, I think it might be my favorite word.
What makes it your favorite word?
I think it's like every time I tell people, their reaction is really funny.
Kind of like my face on the Zoom call that you're seeing every time you say a word, and I'm utterly shocked by it. So.
Krisha Agrawal is a fifth grade student at the Woodland Hill Montessori School who traveled to Washington, D.C. last month to compete in the 2025 Scripps National Spelling Bee. She finished in 100th place, finishing in the third round. She spoke with WAMC's Samantha Simmons. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1809. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.